BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio. Wake up to yesterday on BCFM. Midnight to midday, we repeat all the programmes so you can catch up on all the ones you've missed or just enjoy them again. BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Hello and welcome to Dalek Radio for Saturday the 29th of August. This week, Martin Summers is here, like the HMS Ark Royal, to jargon blast his way through the BBC's Robert Preston, and the City of London's credit crunch fog. Following closely on Martin's heels, journalist John Pilger, seen only rarely on our TV screens these days, gives us his rather dim view of President Obama's record so far. We hear about a new film about Zimbabwe, Fields of Gold, which premiered at the Watershed recently, and Shanks joins us live too. She's from Eastern Urban Design Task Group. And the Freemasons, not the pop group, but the religious cult with their invisible temple in plain sight. Tony Gosling has written this, can you tell? In plain sight at the bottom of Park Street, photographer Christian Payne gets one to talk on the record. But first, I would like to introduce Martin Summers live into the studio. With the credit crunch continuing to bite and the press and broadcasters sending out mixed messages about whether it's all over or not, are the mainstream media genuinely confused or are they just trying to play with our heads? Martin Summers is formerly of the New Economics Foundation, now of the Bristol Debt Advice Centre, or formerly, famously on YouTube predicting the financial crisis just under 2 years ago. Martin Summers, welcome to Dialect.
Hello.
Now, I read in the FT a few days ago, courtesy of Noriel Rubini of the Stern School of Business, saying that we're possibly going to have a W-shaped recession. Some people are saying we're going to have a recovery, I should say. Some people are saying that we're going to come out of the recession in a U-shape, some are saying a V-shape, or even worse, it could be an L-shape. What is all of this? What does this all mean?
Well, we're basically talking about whether the recession is going to end, is going to carry along on the bottom. I mean, there's even worse, which is not just an L-shape, it might be a straight-down shape, if you see what I mean. Right? L-shape implies we hit the bottom and then we run along the bottom,
yeah. Which
is the worst prediction. But of course it might just carry on going down, that's another prediction which has not been mentioned in all of those that you've suggested.
Right.
Noriel Rubini, of course, is the uber bear in mainstream discourse, and what that means is he's the mainstream economist who's the most pessimistic. Although this other chap Taleb, who was with David Cameron recently, is also extremely pessimistic.
I mean, some people are very optimistic. I mean, I saw a quote here from an oil analyst, Edward Meir of MF Global. He says that oil prices are rising. And he says, we could now easily move towards the $80 marks if the growing enthusiasm about the budding economic recovery continues to dominate sentiment.
Well, I think if you print a lot of money, which is what we've done, you can, of course, create a stock market bubble, which is what has happened. And there's no money being lent into the real economy, or hardly any. Most of the money that's been printed and has been given to the banks has been used for stock market speculation, and buying up of oil as well is another speculative bubble.
Right.
So in other words, what we're trying to do, or what the governments have been trying to do, is restart the bubble. And of course, bubbles very much depend upon psychology. Mm. So you say to people, hey, we're turning the corner now, now's the time to buy. And of course, a lot of small investors are thinking, yes, of course, we're turning the corner now, this is the time to buy because all the stocks are cheap.
Yep.
I'll get in at the bottom floor and I'll make money. But all the big boys, all of the senior executives are selling their shares because they recognise that this is actually largely an artificial situation.
This seems to depend kind of what you define as an end. I mean, I've got another quote here from the e-commerce journal online. It says 90% of economists say US recession will end in quarter three, sort of this autumn. How do you define an end to a recession?
Well, what they mean is that the economy, instead of contracting, starts to grow again a little bit.
Right.
Now, if you look at the way in which the Great Depression played out, mm-hmm. the financial crisis of 1929 didn't lead to the full effects on the real economy until 1933.
Right.
So during that period from 1929 to 1933, there were various false green shoots of recovery stories.
Okay, so this is what...
We're seeing a very similar playing out of events as in the 30s, basically.
Okay, so this is what Rubini is talking about when he talks about a W-shaped...
So you get a little bit of a recovery and then bang, you go back down again. I mean, if you think about it, we've just taken another big sugar rush, another line of financial cocaine, and as a result of that, we're still buzzing. But of course, we have actually run out of stuff.
Yeah.
And eventually, we're going to have to face the cold turkey of that. And what the real problem is come the autumn, is that the quantitative easing and money printing and so on that's been going on has been enough to create a stock market bubble, which is great for the insiders because they can then sell out their holdings to all the mugs who come into the market on the basis of all this puffery. But they will lose their money, of course, if the economy crashes again.
Rubini also says something that is incredibly pessimistic that makes you wonder if there is any recovery at all. He says policymakers are damned if they do and damned if they don't. He says here, if they take large fiscal deficits seriously and raise taxes, cut spending and mop up excess liquidity, they would undermine recovery and tip the economy back into stag deflation, recession and deflation. But if they do the opposite and they maintain large budget deficits, then inflationary expectations will increase, long-term government bond yields would rise, borrowing rates would go up sharply, leading to stagflation. Now, in short, without sort of the jargon, he's basically saying if they do this, we're sort of damned, but if they do the other...
Well, it's like having cancer, isn't it? I mean, cancer will kill you if you don't take the chemotherapy, but the chemotherapy might kill you if you do take it. And unfortunately, the economy has been mismanaged by free market fundamentalists for decades now, and we're actually in a no-win situation. We're probably going to have to move to a completely different style of economy. It'll probably require all sorts of social upheavals. If you think of the 30s, you've got fascist takeovers, you've got revolutions, you've got repudiations of debts. We still haven't got to the political and social crisis. The financial crisis is gradually becoming an economic crisis, which becomes a social crisis, which then becomes a political crisis. And we're still just going through the early stages of this. I mean, if you think of the 30s, the bubble was much bigger than the 30s. Mm. So the scale of the crash and the scale of the consequences were all that much more. Governments had more room for manoeuvre in the 30s. Yeah? The governments were actually solvent so that they could, in fact, increase their expenditures. But the US government's been insolvent for decades. So there's a real danger of hyperinflation plus massive unemployment, which is a pretty scary prospect.
I'm aware we're kind of looking at this from a very sort of West-centric sort of outlook. I mean, a lot of the East, particularly China, are taking certain leaves out of the way that capitalism works in the West. And they're sort of doing it in their own particular way. What does this mean for
the East? What's interesting, of course, about China is that their banks are still owned by the government. So they can order them to just lend money, and they have, you know, just press a button and the banks lend money. What we do is we give money to a bankrupt banks and then say, would you like to lend that on? And they go, well, no, we wouldn't really. But the Chinese do have all the levers in place to stimulate their economy if they want to, and they are doing that. It's a good job they are. So the same is true for Western governments. They have to stimulate the economy. The alternative is no alternative. But the problem is that the Chinese, like everybody else, are dependent upon other people's buying their stuff.
Yeah.
They want to reorient their economy towards a more towards their own people, but that's still very difficult to do. But at least they've got some levers to pull.
Right.
The problem with Western governments is that what levers they have got to pull, they've already pulled. They're not actually working terribly well, and in many ways, the banks are still calling the shots.
So, do you think that Western influence is going to continue to decrease?
There's been a very important meeting recently of what they call the BRIC countries, which is Brazil, Russia, India, China, and they banned the UN, the US, and the EU from attending that meeting. Because they wanted to discuss their strategy in relation to the crisis. And, of course, what they want is a new international reserve currency, not the dollar. The problem for all of those BRIC countries, is which are the up-and-coming powerhouse countries, is that they've got lots and lots of dollars. And, of course, they want to get rid of them. But if they panic and get rid of them, then they'll lose all their money. So it's in nobody's interest for the dollar to crash. I mean, so everybody's trying to keep the dollar as the reserve currency because they've got all of their reserves in dollars.
Yeah, I mean,
but nevertheless, this isn't sustainable. And in the autumn, I think we're going to see a run on the dollar probably.
Briefly, I mean, there is some talk in some places that the euro would be a good reserve currency instead. Some people would like that. Do you think it's realistic?
Well, I mean, I think the problem with reserve currencies is it ultimately depends upon who's the biggest beast in the jungle, and right. Europeans just don't have a big enough army to control the oil wells in the other side of the world, etc., etc. The Americans up to now, the US up to now, has had the wherewithal to conquer countries, control their resources, etc. They're going to find it difficult going forward because they won't be able to afford to do all of that anymore.
Okay. I'm trying to sort of bring it a little bit back towards home. What about property prices? People listening to this, you know, a lot of the real effects are really going to be in people's homes and in people's real lives. What do we see happening to the property market?
Well, it's going to, at the best, it's going to stagnate for a long time. At worst, it's going to carry on going down for many years.
Because it has stagnated in places like, I think, like Japan.
Indeed, and the Japanese have never come out of the deflationary shock of 1990, and we're now in 2009. And of course, that's just one country where the rest of the world is still functioning properly. If everybody's going down simultaneously, the chances are that you could get in not just an L-shaped recession, but a straightforward downward spiral. That is the danger. I mean, unfortunately, the people who've managed things have made a big mess of it, a bigger mess than 1929, and the consequences are going to be pretty bad.
Do you foresee a future when I'm sort of your age where, you know, the Western world is no longer the primary dominant power?
Well, that's already happening. I mean, there's obviously power is shifting towards other countries who are up and coming, as opposed to. I mean, that shouldn't be a problem. That doesn't mean that wealthier countries get poorer. It just means that other countries get wealthier, and that's a perfectly natural process.
Okay, yeah.
But the real danger is that the West, in its desire to remain the top dog, has manipulated the whole system to its own interests and actually possibly blocked off the possibility of development for everybody else. It's a kind of dead-end scenario that we could be moving into.
All right. Well, what in the near future, in the next 6 months, do you think it would be the best thing that could happen, that we could do, that Western countries can really be doing?
Well, we've got to reform the banking system, but nobody's grasping that nettle. The banks still have far too much political power. They're able to dictate to governments, even though they're in receipt of government subsidy.
Yeah.
And in actual fact, that makes a mockery of the democratic process. Doesn't matter who we elect, whether it's Brown, Cameron, whoever, the banks are still going to be calling the shots because they're too big to fail. They're in a position where they say, oh, well, you can't let us fail, you've just got to give us some more money. People are going to get very fed up with that, as they did in the 30s, because some people, the very wealthy, are doing perfectly well out of this situation. They're speculating in these bubbles that are being created as a result of money printing. They're actually making money out of the situation, while other people are losing their jobs, their homes, their pensions, their future. And there will be a political backlash.
So
of the right or the left. To
despite some of the famous losses, basically the rich are still getting richer and the poor.
Well, we've got the biggest disparity between rich and poor that we've seen in two or three generations. The top 1% in the United States control something like 80% of the wealth. I mean, this is just ridiculous. And of course, wealthy people don't spend the money on stuff. They invest it in speculative bubbles, which is what the problem is.
Yeah.
We've got to get rid of speculative bubbles and invest in proper things like schools, hospitals, roads, whatever. So all this giving the money to the banks means that we've got no money to spend on schools, hospitals, roads, whatever. So the banks, having made the mess, are now soaking up all of the resources which might be used to solve the mess, and at the same time dictating to everybody else what can and can't be done. This is a confidence trick, essentially, by the banking classes, which is basically the wealthy classes and their financial advisors. But how long the ordinary population will put up with this is a question. At what point will people's patience with all of this snap and real alternatives start to be put forward? I think people at the moment still believe that somehow capitalism will rescue itself. It always has in the past. Surely it will.
Mm.
It won't without massive government intervention of the right sort. At the moment, we've got government intervention of the wrong sort. It'll take a political struggle by people all over the world to demand government intervention of the right sort. But most people are still in shock from what's happened. They don't really understand what's happened. They haven't thought through the consequences. They haven't created the political movements necessary to push for the changes that are required. And, of course, in a recession, people are struggling to survive. So that also creates problems, which makes it very difficult for them to do anything else.
All right, I'll wrap it up at that point and leave listeners with the question, at what point will your patience snap with the banks? Let's all ask ourselves that. Martin Summers, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Australian-born journalist John Pilger is probably best known for his epic ITV documentaries telling the hidden stories in conflict zones from Vietnam to the West Bank and Gaza in Israeli-occupied Palestine. His last film, The War on Democracy, has won several awards and is about the United States' interventions in Latin America. But with the demise of ITV, so it is possible that the era of films has come to an end. As the man himself might say, though, never fear, Mr. Pilger's analysis of the first few months of the presidency of Barack Obama is just as fearless as his previous films. And we're bringing you his recent speech in Australia, split up over the next 3 weeks. This week, part one, he recalls a scene from US-occupied Vietnam in the early 1970s.
Now, 2 years ago, I spoke about an invisible government, which was a term used by Edward Bernays, one of the founders of modern propaganda. It was Bernays who, in the 1920s, invented public relations as a euphemism for propaganda. And it was Bernays, deploying the ideas of his uncle, Sigmund Freud, who campaigned on behalf of the tobacco industry for women to take up smoking as an act of feminist liberation, he calling cigarettes torches of freedom. At the same time, he was involved in the disinformation that was critical in overthrowing the Arbenz government in Guatemala. So you have the association there of cigarettes and regime change. The invisible government that Bernays had in mind brought together all media, PR, the press, broadcasting, advertising, and their power of branding and image making. In other words, disinformation. And I suppose I'd like to talk today about this invisible government's most recent achievement, the rise of Barack Obama, and the silencing of much of the left. But all of this has a history, of course, and I'd like to go back, take you back some 40 years to a sultry and, for me, very memorable day in Vietnam. I was a young war correspondent who had just arrived in a village in the central highlands called Thuy Long. My assignment was to write about a unit of U.S. Marines who had been sent to the village to win hearts and minds. "My orders," said the Marine sergeant, "are to sell the American way of liberty as stated in the Pacification Handbook. This is designed to win the hearts and minds of folks as stated on page 86. Now, page 86 was headed in capital letters, WHAM, winning hearts and minds. The Marine unit was a combined action company, which, explained the sergeant, meant, and I quote, "We attack these folks on Mondays and we win their hearts and minds on Tuesdays," unquote. He was joking, of course, but not quite. The sergeant, who didn't speak Vietnamese, had arrived in the village, stood up in a jeep, and said through a bullhorn, "Come on out, everybody. We got rice and candies and toothbrushes to give you." This was greeted by silence. "Now listen, either you gooks come on out or we're going to come right in there and get you." Now the people of Thuy Long finally came out and they stood in line to receive packets of Uncle Ben's Miracle Rice, Hershey bars, party balloons, and several thousand toothbrushes. Three portable battery-operated yellow flush lavatories were held back for the arrival of the colonel. And when the colonel arrived that evening, the district chief was summoned, and the yellow flush lavatories unveiled. The colonel cleared his throat and took out a handwritten speech. "Mr. District Chief, and all you nice people," said the colonel, "what these gifts represent is more than the sum of their parts. They carry the spirit of America." I promise you I'm quoting verbatim. "Ladies and gentlemen, there's no place on earth like America. It's the land where miracles happen. It's a guiding light for me and for you. In America, you see, we count ourselves as real lucky as having the greatest democracy the world has ever known, and we want you nice people to share in our good fortune. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, even John Winthrop's City Upon a Hill got a mention. All that was missing was the Star-Spangled Banner playing softly in the background. Of course, the villagers had no idea what the colonel was talking about, but when the Marines clapped, they clapped, and when the colonel waved, the children waved. And when he departed, the colonel shook the sergeant's hands and said, "We've got plenty of hearts and minds here. Carry on, sergeant." "Yes, sir." In Vietnam, I witnessed many scenes like that. I'd grown up in faraway Australia on a cinematic diet of John Wayne, Randolph Scott, Walt Disney, and Ronald Reagan. The American way of liberty they portrayed might well have been lifted from the Wham handbook. I'd learned that the United States had won World War II on its own and now led the free world as the chosen society. It was only later when I read Walter Lippmann's book, Public Opinion, A Manual of the Invisible Government, that I began to understand the power of emotions attached to false ideas and bad histories on a grand scale. Now, historians call this exceptionalism, the notion that the United States has a divine right to bring what it calls liberty to the rest of humanity. Of course, this is a very old refrain. The French and British created and celebrated their own civilizing missions while imposing colonial regimes that denied basic civil liberties. However, the power of the American message was and remains different. Whereas the Europeans were proud imperialists, Americans are trained to deny their imperialism. As Mexico was conquered and the Marines sent to Nicaragua, American textbooks referred to an age of innocence. American motives were always well-meaning, moral, exceptional, as the colonel said. There was no ideology, they said, and that's still the case. Americanism is an ideology that is unique because its main feature is its denial that it is an ideology. It's both conservative and it's liberal, and it's right and it's left. And Barack Obama is its embodiment. Since Obama was elected, leading liberals have talked about America returning to its true status as, and I quote, "a nation of moral ideals." Those are the words of Paul Krugman, the liberal columnist of the New York Times. In the San Francisco Chronicle, columnist Mark Morford wrote, and I quote, "Spiritually advanced people regard the new president as a light worker who can help usher in a new way of being on the planet," unquote. Tell that to an Afghan child whose family has been blown away by Obama's bombs, or a Pakistani child whose house has been visited by one of Obama's drones, or a Palestinian child surveying the carnage in Gaza caused by American smart weapons, which, disclosed Seymour Hersh, were resupplied to Israel for use in the slaughter, and I quote, "only after the Obama team let it be known it would not object." The man who stayed silent on Gaza is the man who now condemns Iran. In a sense, Obama is the myth that is America's last taboo. His most consistent theme was never change, it was power. The United States, he said, and I quote, "leads the world in battling immediate evils and promoting the ultimate good. We must lead by building a 21st century military to ensure the security of our people and advance the security of all people." And there is this remarkable statement, and I quote, "at moments of great peril in the past century, our leaders ensured that America, by deed and by example, led and lifted the world, that we stood and fought for the freedom sought by billions of people beyond our borders," unquote. Words like these remind me of the colonel in the village in Vietnam as he spun much the same nonsense. Since 1945, by deed and by example, to use Obama's words, America has overthrown 50 governments, including democracies, and crushed some 30 liberation movements, and bombed countless men, women, and children to death. I'm grateful to Bill Blum for his cataloguing of that. And yet here is the 45th president of the United States having stacked his government with warmongers and corporate fraudsters and polluters from the Bush and Clinton eras, promising not only more of the same, but a whole new war in Pakistan, justified by the murderous clichés of Hillary Clinton, clichés like high-value targets. Within 3 days of his inauguration, Obama was ordering the death of people in faraway countries, Pakistan and Afghanistan.
That was Australian journalist, author and New Statesman magazine columnist John Pilger, and we'll be hearing more of his assessment of the new US president here on Dialect next week, and I shall look forward to it.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
The closet world of secret handshakes, and they have a large but discreet temple by, and this might surprise you, the Mauritania at the bottom of Park Street, something I've walked past many, many times, more times than I remember, and I never knew. The Freemasons usually do everything they can to stay out of the limelight, no surprise there, or should I say, to keep the fact that they are Freemason out of the limelight. Councillors who are Freemasons now have a statutory duty to disclose the fact in the Register of Members' Interests, but no such duty exists for council officers who nobody elects. To join, you have to believe in a supreme being and in an afterlife, but you are not permitted to discuss religion. Though some Freemasons deny that the initiation rites still include blood-curdling oaths of secrecy and loyalty to brother Masons. So what's it all about? Professional photographer Christian Payne, who runs the documentary website and www.ourmaninside.com, got a senior Freemason to agree to give a rare interview on the record.
There are about 40 different degrees in Freemasonry, all of which have got smaller degrees as well. So you could call me a Knights Templar priest, and I'm a past Knights Templar priest because I've been the captain of my preceptory, and I'm a member of Grand College of the Knights Templar priests. I suppose that's the highest thing I am, if there is a high and if there is a low, and that's debatable.
You're being mysterious.
I'm not being mysterious, they're all brothers, and there are brothers with money and brothers with rank and some brothers without, but they're all brothers. And that's the whole secret that a lot of people don't understand about Freemasonry. It's a leveller. We use the word level.
Ah, so there is a hierarchy, but
yes,
everybody is equal.
Everybody is equal. I mean, that's the thing that annoys an awful lot of people. We are all equal brothers within the rank. It's only, a lot of it, you see, I'll whisper to you, it's Buggins' turn. When you join is when you start on the ladder. And if you were to join like I did when I was 22, 23, my dad was a Freemason. And that makes me a thing called a Lewis. And if you have a look at in architecture what a Lewis is, that's the son of a Freemason. I get privileges that I go into Freemasonry first. So I start on this ladder and climb. If I want to climb, you don't have to. So I've been there for a long time. So this is my 41st year in Freemasonry, which makes me very old. And I still don't understand it. I should also tell you, I've met some of the most horrible, detestable people ever in Freemasonry.
Wow.
I've also met some wonderful people too. And I suppose the wonderful outrank the others, but there are some nasty people, because what you've got to see is it's milling. They knock the edges off you. We talk about that in Freemasonry, about the gavel knocking off all superfluous knobs and excrescences. See, it's highly stylized, all the Masonic writings. And that's another good thing about Masonry. It teaches you to public speak and to announce yourself clearly.
Okay. So, do you see yourself as being a Freemason for the rest of your days?
Once a Freemason, unfortunately, always a Freemason.
Has
yes,
it,
but
has it assisted you in your life?
Well, again, just a quiet whisper to you, I joined the Manchester City Police in 1964, and I was asked a question by the Chief Constable on my recruitment. What's the name of your parish priest? And at that time, the Masons and the Roman Catholics were daggers drawn. So you could say that for the first 20 years in the police, it didn't help me at all. On the contrary, had the senior officers of the Manchester Police found out that I was a Freemason, he would have sent me backwards.
Really?
Absolutely. It was a detestation amongst Catholics for Freemasons. And actually, vice versa.
So where would it benefit you being a Freemason?
It would benefit me because I do meet the most wonderful people. So it is a networking system. It really is a networking system. But you must realise, if I took you into my lodge as an initiate, you could not discuss work, you could not discuss religion, and you could not discuss politics. So it's airy-fairy stuff. But hey, we know what you do. All this mafia sort, the Freemasons rule the world. They can't rule the world because they don't know who's in the other lodge. You do meet people. You give the secret handshake, which incidentally is very similar to the Catinian Roman Catholic handshake. You give that handshake. That's given to somebody. But very often I'll never use that because you can make enemies without really trying. People do know how to do the Masonic handshake.
Right. And there's the, yeah. There's the words
there's
as well.
There's the words that go with it, yes. I mean, I can drop a cautious word into the conversation, as I just did then. And then you could say to me, why did you say cautious then? But every Freemason that's in England would know that. The French Freemason, and I'm a French senior French Freemason in the Grand Chapter of France, they would not understand the word cautious, even if it was translated into French. They don't use the same words.
That was an anonymous Freemason there, talking to Christian Payne from OurManInside.com. African Eye and African Voices Forum took over the Watershed Cinema a week last Friday for the world premiere screening of Tides of Gold. Husband and wife team Simon Bright and Ingrid Sinclair co-directed the film.
Hi, I'm Simon Bright. I'm the director of Africa Eye Film Festival, and tonight we're going to be watching a film that I made together with my wife when we were living in Zimbabwe, and the film is called Tides of Gold.
Can you tell us a bit about the background to the film?
Yeah, it's about the Kingdom of Monomotapa, which was an African empire that existed from roughly the 10th to the 13th century after the birth of Christ. So medieval times in English terms. They built these tremendous monuments, which you see in the film. The palaces were built out of granite, and they were built in dry stone walling. Some of the walls are 35 feet high, 15 foot thick, and cover an area of several acres.
Where is this?
It's in the southeast corner of Zimbabwe today, and the country is actually called after this monument. Zimbabwe means houses of stone, and these are the houses of stone.
So why did the empire decline?
The empire declined for a variety of reasons, which, I mean, it's speculative. One of the speculations is that the population grew too big for the local environment to sustain it. And, you know, it was 15,000 people. It doesn't sound much, but London, I don't know how big London was in the 12th century, but it wasn't hugely much bigger than that. So there's a lot of pressure on the environment. But the other thing is that the trade routes, I believe, changed because the Portuguese came around the Cape in the late 1400s. And they displaced the Swahili traders, and they then moved the trade route up the Zambezi. And eventually the Monomotapa moved his capital to Muzurubani in the Zambezi.
And is that capital still there?
Yeah, they know the site of that. But you have outcrops of Zimbabwe stretching from Botswana into Zambia, into northern South Africa, and down as far as Mozambique. That was really a big area that it covered. But I mean, the film Triads of Gold is not just about Great Zimbabwe. It's about the trade that they had in gold and ivory and various other animal products with the Mozambican coast. And then you had these Muslim Africans, Swahili, the Swahili kingdom, city-states, sailing dhows up the coast and trading with the Middle East, with India, and as far as China. So you find Chinese porcelain at Great Zimbabwe.
Expensive taste, then.
Yeah, I mean, I should think, you know, getting his silk from China and his porcelain, yeah, he could afford it. He had the gold. There's quite a lot of gold in Zimbabwe. So I think everybody has a taste for the exotic, and, you know, if you're living in the center of Africa and you suddenly come across Chinese silk, I mean, in the same way as for the Chinese, you know, they did amazing things, like imported a live giraffe to China from Kenya in the 1400s. And when this giraffe arrived in the Ming Emperor's palace, it apparently created the resonance of some mythical creature from Chinese mythology. And it was a beast of exceptional good fortune. So the Ming Emperor then used the evidence of this giraffe that arrived in his palace to show that he was blessed by the gods and that his reign would be perpetual, and, you know, he used it politically.
How did that empire compare to other empires across the world, like the Inca?
Like the Inca, it was also based on gold. I mean, their tradable commodity was gold. They didn't build square buildings, and they didn't build a very deep foundation. In a sense, it depended on a king or an emperor who extracted the surplus value from a range of peasants who were producing the food and the meat to enable other people to work gold and iron and build stone walls. So in that sense, very similar.
Were they highly decorated, the palaces?
Actually, they lived in huts within the palaces, because the palaces were monumental structures designed to impress with the power of the emperor. But the actual buildings that the emperor and his wives and nobles lived in were huts, because a hut is a very good structure for Africa. You know, the thatch provides insulation, and you know, it's a pretty comfortable structure to live in.
Was this the first film you made about Zimbabwe?
No, I mean, that was one of my later films. My first film was in 1986, called Corridors of Freedom. Well, it's not just about Zimbabwe. It's about Zimbabwe and it's about Mozambique, and it goes to Tanzania, it goes to Madagascar, Comores, South Africa. It covers the whole region.
Is there a website?
We have a website called AfricaEye.org. We've got a film festival coming up at the end of October, so we urge all your listeners to come along. It's our annual Africa Eye Film Festival.
That was Anthony Page talking to Simon Bright, co-director with Ingrid Sinclair, for the film Tides of Gold, which was premiered at the Watershed Cinema, Bristol, a week last Friday. Interesting point of information, if you liked the little music that opened it, from the Zimbabwean Mbira player, you can buy an Mbira, which is a sort of thumb piano, from Hobgoblin Music at the bottom of Park Street.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'd like to welcome to the studio Shanks. He's simply known as Shanks.
Yes, that's right.
Now, you're part of the Love Eastern Urban Design Task Group.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, tell us a little bit about what that is. What does it mean?
Well, we set up as a group of residents back in February 2009, simply because there's lots and lots of regeneration documents that have been done by Bristol City Council for Eastern, from the Stapleton Road Master Plan to housing association needs studies and stuff, and none of them have actually been combined together to create an urban design document that speaks for the communities in Eastern and what people might want in the area.
Okay, so you're trying to sort of connect the council's good intentions with the people of Eastern to make something that's actually going to work.
Yeah, that's the idea, because Bristol City Council at the moment are going through their core development strategy and setting up policies and stuff, but we don't see how that's going to be implemented locally and actually look at the visions and aspirations of the local community. And each area has its own identity and how that links in with the policy. So hopefully through doing a series of community consultation events over the month of October, we'll find out exactly what people want from the area and visions and aspirations, as well as looking at smaller pockets.
Okay.
And then find out from that how to put together a document that will hopefully lead to maybe a supplementary planning document with Bristol City Council, but we don't know yet.
I mean,
that's sure, potential.
There are such a varied group of groups of people, in plural, in the Eastern. I mean, there are some that are, if anybody's ever been to Eastern, tell a little bit about your experience of all the varied groups of Eastern and sort of your own.
Well, it's
how do
so.
You unite them all in?
Well, we have. That's one of the tricks that we've got to work out, because we're going to do a huge sort of marketing campaign over September, simply through engaging people in the idea of consultation. Because to some, I think it's quite a boring sort of idea to feel that they can engage with. And so we've got loveeastern.com, and we're going to make big banners and put them on loads of sort of community shops and sort of the leisure centre and cafes and things. And hopefully people will subscribe to the website via it. And then we can tell them about all the consultation events and get them to engage with it.
Yeah. So what sort of different varieties of minorities do we have?
Somalians, Eritreans, Ethiopians, lots of Pakistanis, and then lots of sort of young professionals that have moved in as well, so it's really mixed and diverse.
Yeah. Do you think it's about time for something to be done in Eastern? Because, like, Stapleton Road is a bit notorious.
Yeah, it is notorious. I think, like, it's still a great place, and it's so vibrant, and probably one of the most interesting parts of town, and at night as well, one of the only places that is really alive and bubbling at night. And it's just bringing all of that out and engaging people with each other as well, because they're quite segregated communities. But finding things, I don't know, like skate parks and cafes and things that can almost become catalysts for regeneration, which we're looking into as well, hopefully setting up a sort of Love Eastern cafe and getting sort of local Somalian women and people to come and cook food of an evening, just maybe one dish,
yeah,
that then you could sell for sort of £3 a meal and try and bring lots of different communities together with food. So, yeah, we're going to try lots of different ways to engage people together to get ideas for the area.
OK, Bristol City Council is a little bit notorious. I mean, how have you found trying to communicate with them and their plans for urban redevelopment? What are they like?
Well, I've sort of been told outrightly that what we're trying to do and the process that we're going about doing it isn't going to turn into a supplementary planning document. But at the very least, we get to speak for as large a majority of the area and people as possible and get new visions for Eastern. And at the very most, maybe in 2 or 3 years' time, when there's a shake-up in the council, it will get adopted.
Okay, so do you feel at the moment, if you weren't around and this Love Eastern group wasn't around, it would be a little bit like the council just sort of does something to Eastern, whether they like it or not? Is that the attitude,
I
think?
Yeah, I think so.
So what can people do, you said, mention stuff that's coming up in October, if sort of people are in Eastern sort of listening to this, how can they get involved and what can they
well,
do?
Well, we've got the Stapleton Road Street Party, which is on October the 3rd, which will also be the launch of the Love Eastern Community Cafe for that month, which is where we hope that people come and drop in and consult on things they love about Eastern and areas that they like. It's 5 Stapleton Road.
Okay.
It's just around the corner from the Trinity Centre.
Okay, right, yeah. So you can go along to that. How can they sort of, what sort of ways can they sort of put across their opinion about what they want for Eastern? In what sort of ways are we talking about?
Okay, so we're going to try lots of arts and creative ways, such as we'll have workshops where we'll give people cameras and we'll send them out on the streets to take photos of parts of the city, like the area that they like and they don't like, as well as large maps where they can come and tag the place that they live and say what they love about Easton, and that will all get documented as well. And also like lots and lots of maps where they can tag bits that they where they feel unsafe or where they, the bits that they love, and so we try and, you know, keep those assets that Easton has.
Okay, cool. Well, a reminder, loveeastern.com is the website to look at, and I wish you and your urban design task group all the very best.
Thanks.
Thanks for coming in.
Great.
On the 1st of April this year, London was gripped by G20 fever. Whether or not it was a coincidence that the bailout package was agreed on All Fools' Day has been forgotten, and the enduring memory of that day is the death of Ian Tomlinson, knocked to the ground by an unnamed riot policeman. What is notable about the Tomlinson episode is that the police officer involved removed his epaulets with his identity number, which is contrary to police regulations. He also donned a balaclava to conceal his face. Do these actions suggest that he may have been about to embark on illegal activity? Anyway, the horrible episode has shown that CCTV footage can easily go missing and highlighted the value of public video camera witness evidence. This week, a senior Metropolitan Police officer admitted that only one CCTV camera in 1,000 has helped solve a crime, but the same is not true for citizen video journalists. Tony Cripps was one of the pioneer video activists filming Reclaim the Streets parties and running video courses in the 1990s, and Dialect's Tony Gosling asked him how he used his camcorder to gather evidence and be a citizen video journalist.
I used to run a workshop on site to show people, enthusiastic sort of like young camera people, tips on how not to get nicked on the street, get snatched, how to get the proper video that was required for editing and where to put it as well. You could see that what the police were doing in those days, I mean, they spent millions of pounds on perfecting their sort of evidence gathering, as they called themselves in those days. I don't know what they're calling themselves.
Well, I think it's the FIT team, isn't it? Oh, Forward Intelligence Team is what they're called now. Yeah. And there's a whole campaign against that.
Yeah, but, well, there should be as well.
Can you just tell us what these workshops consisted of? Your camcorders are getting cheaper and cheaper. And if someone wants to film at a big demonstration or whatever to gather evidence or for whatever reason, often it's quite intimidating for people, isn't it? Because they feel they might be arrested, or they may be targeted by either the police or the demonstrators to take their camera away.
Yeah, and that's probably going to become more and more relevant as the police become more and more aggressive in their approach to demonstrations and you know, political activism, really. I mean, it's coming up again. We just haven't got the kind of situations we had in the 90s. Video cameras weren't as easy to get hold of, and people didn't have the money, to be able to go out and buy themselves a video camera off hot as, they can nowadays. They're a lot cheaper, and like you say, there's a lot more technology these days, which is a lot cheaper with the computers and the various different formats that can be used.
Okay, so what techniques were you encouraging people to adopt to make sure that they went home with the footage or were then able possibly even to sell it onto news networks?
Right, well, I think that in the workshops that I ran, I would encourage people to, you know, look at the police first of all, go out onto the streets and watch what they did, because they're spending millions of pounds on teaching, learning and watching us, you know, watching us, watching you, watching us. And one of the important things is it's very easy to get carried away when you're in a situation where there's a lot going on. It's just, you know, perhaps stay calm, watch the police, the FIT teams, and see how they do things, and then copy them. They're spending money, taxpayers' money, and a lot of it on learning how to do things properly. You don't need to spend that money. You don't even need to have the money. You just watch what they do. If you mimic it, it's very hard for them to actually react against it.
But that's very difficult in the middle of a demonstration. Say, for example, when there's, violence kicks off at some point. I mean, the temptation surely then is to just panic and run off.
Well, that's a temptation, but it's not always the wisest thing to do. I used to find that, if you're right there in the front line, as I called it, sometimes some of the best things to do is to actually stand your ground. And I would encourage people to actually get together as groups. You always see the lone cameraman out there, and they're very, very prone and very, very vulnerable to being snatched. And if they get that, if they get snatched, obviously their footage and
you
their
mean
equipment.
Arrested, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, arrested. And, you know, if, for instance, it does get hot, my advice would be don't panic, but to stay calm. If you need to take a step back and view the situation, do that. But then think about, you know, asking some of your friends to actually come in with you. It's always wise to have someone, if you're on the camera, you can't have your eyes around everywhere. So it's always wise, and I would encourage people to look for their friends, get their friends to actually come behind them and around them, and always have someone with a hand on your shoulder. That way, if something is going to happen to you, they can get you out of the situation pretty quickly. And also, with regards to footage, I mean, one of the things that the police were really into getting hold of, it wasn't necessarily to arrest a cameraman who, let's face it, isn't really doing that much wrong, but it would be to take the footage, because that footage could be evidence against them.
Yeah, but the thing is, afterwards, they have to give you the footage back anyway.
Yeah, but
I mean, one of the things I came across a lot was that these people were actually filming and then selling on to the local news companies, BBC or ITV companies, for that night's news. And of course, if you were arrested, you've missed the opportunity to do that. The next day, it's old news.
You missed the opportunity, but also, I mean, the camera never lies. If you're in a demonstration situation and you're filming, more often than not, you're going to be picking up stuff that you don't want the police to have. Because you're also trying to protect the people that are around you.
So have you ever actually used footage, filmed stuff that's been useful in court cases after the demonstration?
Knutsford Crown Court. I went up to Knutsford Crown Court and used video footage to conclusively prove that certain people had been arrested at the time. They weren't in fact guilty of what they were being accused of.
So really this is it's a form of evidence gathering at these demonstrations.
Yeah, it's exactly the same really as what the police are doing, and you have to remember that all the time, and remember that you have a responsibility at these gatherings as a cameraman. We all have a responsibility to ourselves and those close around us, but you have a responsibility not only to the you know, the well-being of the people around you at the time, but you're also a responsibility to the issues at hand as well. You're there to you know, record them, and you're there to document them. And for whatever reason that is, it's important that you stay on that and don't lose sight of that. Why else are you there? Most demonstrations take place in towns and cities. And, you know, if you just go out the door now and you have a look down the road, you're going to see a post box pretty much everywhere. There's a post box on the corner here, a post box on the corner there. Now, the thing is, if you happen to film something that, you know, is a bit sort of out of order, police kicking off, or you've got footage in your can that you don't want people to get hold of immediately, and you feel in danger. The idea of the jiffy bag is that you can eject the tape or the disc straight away, really, get that into a jiffy bag, which your mate's got, it's pre-addressed, and it goes straight into a post box. The police can't break into the post box just to get a jiffy bag out. So your footage is pretty safe, and it's on its way somewhere safe as well, so you can carry on filming without, you know, the discomfort of feeling that you've got all this stuff on you, which could, in effect, you know, incriminate people.
So if anyone's interested in doing this sort of photojournalism and evidence gathering, sure. Is there anywhere on the internet to look to find?
I would suggest Undercurrents. Undercurrents have been around for a very long time. In fact, they were the first alternative media company in this country. And as a result of Undercurrents, I believe that most of indie media international are now up and running and doing very well. They're very successful. I don't know.
I have to hold my hands up because I worked for Undercurrents for a couple of years, voluntary work in Oxford back in the mid-90s.
Yeah, sure.
And
sure.
I found it really an interesting place. What they were doing really was doing short films about demonstrations and stuff that wasn't getting onto the news.
Absolutely, and they were primarily responsible for bringing over mainstream media to, especially the BBC, to actually coming in and working more closely with alternative media. It got to a point where they had no alternative because they weren't able to get the kind of material that we were.
And the nice thing is, of course, if you are a photojournalist using your video camera, you can actually sell this stuff to the news.
Right, of course.
And it depends on how exclusive it is. But, you know, if you've filmed it, you retain the copyright, and every time someone from television uses it, then they have to pay you.
Well, absolutely. But you need to make sure, absolutely sure, that that's agreed. When you sell the footage, you need to make absolutely certain that you retain the copyright. Otherwise, some of these companies will, in fact, give you 20 quid and nick the lot. Like, you know, they're a bit unscrupulous like that.
Okay, Tony, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect today.
You're welcome. Pleasure.
That's the two Tonys there. Dialect's Tony Gosling talking there to video activist Tony Cripps. And the Undercurrents sites mentioned, the Tonys mentioned there, is www.undercurrents.org. Well, I'd like to welcome to the studio now somebody who's been a guest before and he's perfectly delightful, Trev, the Bard of Bedminster. Hello.
Windmill Hill.
Windmill Hill?
The Bard of Windmill Hill.
Okay, you're here just to give us chapters briefly about the poetry festival that's going on. So tell me a little bit about the poetry festival and are you taking part in it?
Yes, I organised an earlier event, and there's another event on the 8th of September, mm-hmm. which is Poetry at the Lansdowne. We have a guest speaker, Robert Graves, who'll be talking about his famous uncle. There's also films, there's readings from the Lansdowne poets. There are also going to be a film that I made to do with the Banksy phenomenon.
Okay.
Or well, cityscape.
And is that on at the...
That's all happening on the 8th.
Yeah. That's happening on the 8th as well. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, and the film is being shown at the Lansdowne as well?
Yes, all part of the same show. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. It seems a lot. I'm looking at this sort of voluminous leaflet that's sort of distractingly huge. A lot of things seem to be happening at the Arnold Feeney, so if you're at all curious, I think the best idea really is just sort of go to the Arnold Feeney and something will probably be on. Are there any sort of big poetry names that are sort of coming to Bristol that you're keen to see?
Well, there's Matt Harvey, who's hearing at least two events.
Mm-hmm.
He's just been doing a one-man show at Edinburgh.
So describe a little bit about a poetry slam. There's an all-star poetry slam. What is a poetry slam for the uninitiated?
A poetry slam for the uninitiated. It's a poetry competition.
Right.
And generally, the slammers have 3 minutes to impress the judges and the audience.
Okay.
And so you need to try and ham things up a bit, really, so it tends to be quite dramatic. And then it'll be marked according to the how well they do and progress on to the next round.
Okay, how do you feel that this the poetry festival has been, what is going to be, compared to past ones? Do you think it's, is it a bigger and better one this year than it's ever been?
It's pretty much similar to last year as far as I mean, in terms of the format.
Yeah.
But I think there seems to be more things happening at other venues around the city.
Okay.
Not just at Arnold Feeney,
Okay, right.
Stuff at Tobacco Factory. And then there's, of course, there's a slam at the Coton Hall, which is going to be quite a big event. It'll be interesting to see.
That's from the 3rd to the 24th of September at 8 p.m.
Mm. Yeah, the leaflets are available from the Arnold Feeney, or any local library should have them.
Oh, thank you very much for coming in.
That's no problem.
As Trevor the Bard of Windmill Hill has pointed out, you can pick this leaflet up at the Arnold Feeney, local libraries, or you can visit www.poetrycan.co.uk. Well, that's all for this week's show, I'm afraid. What a packed show it's been. No Jeff this week. He's away, but I think he's back next week. So if you want to know what's on, I'm sure you'll be able to find out in the Evening Post. Dialect is a community internet radio station broadcast on Bristol Community FM on the airwaves at 93.2 FM and across the city at 9 p.m. every Saturday, and we're repeated at 6 p.m. every Sunday evening. You can find us on the web at dialectradio.co.uk, and you can look into BCFM at bcfm.org.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and that means anyone can contribute, which means you out there in listener land. If you want to know sort of what it's like, or you want to get involved, just sort of come along and hang out and see what we do. If you'd like to, either in reporting or engineering, or just making the tea, get in touch by volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, or you can find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thank you to our studio guests, Martin Summers, Trevor, the Bard of Windmill Hill, and Shanks. Don't forget to visit loveeaston.com. Reports this week were Tony Gosling and Anthony Page, and studio production was by Mark Condon, and the producer was Tony Gosling. Next week, we have part two of John Pilger's critical portrait of US President Barack Obama, and Anthony Page talks to a conjurer, Sir Richard Haygate, no less, about his book on the history of English magic. That was Dialects, and I'm John Peters Common, wishing a very good week from all the team in our Queen Square studio in Bristol. And let's hope we get a little bit more sunshine before the end of the summer.